Welcome to the Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to the laboratory accreditation industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you'd like to tune into our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjlabs.com or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the last webinar of 2020. My name is Michael Kramer. I'm the Calibration Program Manager at Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation. I want to thank everybody for logging in. We have quite a few people online with us today. Today's webinar is going to be based on two sections within the ISO IEC 17025 2017 standard. We're going to look at section 7.6 and 7.7, which has to do with the evaluation of measurement uncertainty and then also the validity of results. So again, thank you everybody. I'm really glad you're able to join us. So we're going to jump right on into it. Section 7.6 is the evaluation of measurement uncertainty. So there's three clauses here, and there's a few notes here for guidance. Very first requirement, this comes right out of the standard. The laboratory shall identify the contributors to measurement uncertainty when evaluating measure uncertainty. All contributors that are significant, including those arising from sampling, shall be taken into account using appropriate methods of analysis. So there's folks that are accredited with us and are familiar with PL3. If you think about that, that sounds exactly like an uncertainty budget. One thing for those of you that are transitioning, we're still going through the transitioning period that was previously under the 2005. That required a formal procedure. That is no longer required in 2017. You see what the requirement is stated there in 7.6.1. However, if you have a procedure, that is a vehicle if it works for you, and if it includes what's stated in 7.6.1, then by all means you can continue to use that. So just some basic things on uncertainty. So uncertainty is kind of a hard thing to please everyone with. There's lots of different types of calibrations. There's lots of different tests. It really depends. It can be specific to what's being calibrated, to what's or of course what's being tested as far as how uncertainty is to be handled. It's not a one shoe fits all. So Basically, uncertainty contributors are categorized as type A or type B based on the manner in which they are evaluated. Type A evaluation involves evaluations by statistical methods of a series of results. Type B evaluations is evaluations by any means other than statistical. For example, contributors you perhaps get out of reference books, published values, experience, judgment. There are several different types of distributions that are commonly encountered in estimating uncertainty. So got them presented here. We'll take a look at these in a little bit more detail in a bit. Typically, we'll see most popular are those first two, normal distribution, which is one standard deviation, which is a divisor of one, rectangular, which is one standard deviation divided by square root of 3. Then we have triangular, one standard deviation divided by 6. And then U-distribution, which is one standard deviation divided by the square root of 2. So in a nutshell, when we're doing uncertainty, we're identifying contributors, or in fact, we are doing an uncertainty budget. Basically, what we're doing is we're identifying those contributors to uncertainty, so significant contributors. And then we have to quantify them in some manner, and then we combine them. And here's an example of an uncertainty budget. This particular one is in regards to an IR temperature. You can see the various components identified, quantified, and then combined and then expanded. So sources of uncertainty, and by all means, this is not an all-encompassing list here. The first three I like to often refer to them as the big three, because in calibration, and bear in mind, I am a calibration program manager, and that's my area. So, you know, this can, with you folks involved in testing, uncertainty may be looked at a lot different than it is for your calibration laboratories. First one should always be included. That's the uncertainty of the standard used. So in other words, when you send your standards out that you're using in your calibrations or testing, that you're being compared to your units under test, you should have an uncertainty associated with that. Should come right on the report. You ever hear of the link of traceability? Look at a big chain, and it goes, a lot of folks like to see traceability referenced through NIST to the SI, where that link ends. So you're going to be adding to that link there with the uncertainty of the standard use. You're going to take that, and then you're going to look at all the other contributors on top of that. That's going to be particular to your laboratory and your environment, and your folks, and your instrumentation. Number two there is always uncertainty with limited resolution. So what that means, and I'm referring to the unit under test. Let's take, for example, a thermometer, where you have a thermometer that's being calibrated. It's in the limited resolution is the division size. It could be in 1 degree C. It could be in 0.1 degrees C, for example. So the uncertainty associated with that is kind of associated with the breakpoints. You know exactly, you know, what it's reading, but chances are it's not exactly there. It's somewhere between there and then the next resolution. There's a breakpoint somewhere, and there's uncertainty associated with that. Always uncertainty to repeatability. You have repeat measurements. You're not going to perhaps get the same reading every time. Different devices may repeat differently. And basically, that is a standard deviation on over a series of measurements. Other things, and again, from there on out, as far as calibration or those folks that are testing that needs to evaluate uncertainty, these other items I have listed here would be specific to the items that that you're determining the measurement uncertainty on. You usually have them often with environmental. So if, say, temperature affects the calibration or testing that's being done, you're measuring it, there's an uncertainty associated with that. Uncertainty is associated with equipment accuracy. I often refer to that as drift. Used a lot in electronics. Oftentimes you'll see between calibrations, for example, it's not going to maintain that value. You'll see a drift associated with it. Often you can get that from manufacturer specs. However, after you get some history behind the device, as it's something that you can evaluate on your own if you have enough data to basically make that determination. Other things that may be included is uncertainty in regards to properties and conditions of the unit under test, reflectiveness, hardness. Units exhibit sometimes wear that might contribute to uncertainty. Could get some other contributors from manufacturer specifications. Homogeneity or uniformity can often be incorporated, and that's within the environment. So we mentioned about distributions. I just want to go over those four really quick for you here. One of the most common is the normal distribution, which is depicted there. This is typically associated with a type A from your repeated readings. Often that is basically a divisor of one, where 95% of the values are going to fall with what is pictured there on the right hand side of the screen about the means. So that's one standard deviation and two standard deviations. One thing I want to mention here, I mentioned the uncertainty of the standard. That is often associated with a normal distribution. However, most of the time you already see that's been multiplied by two. So typically when you get your uncertainty off of your calibration report, you would divide that by two. Uniform or rectangular, that is often quantified by square root of 3 or 1.173. Population has finite boundaries, and all elements have an equal probability of occurrence. So in other words, this is an area rectangular, the values aren't going to change. For example, if there's a manufacturer specs that's used, it's fixed. It's not going to change. Resolution of the device. It is what it is. It's not going to change. If it reads to a 1 degree C or 0.10 degrees C, that's going to stay the same throughout the course of the calibration. Sort of depicted there on the right. A triangular distribution, not fully defined by the mean, and basically has a standard deviation of the square root of 6 or 2.45. Population has finite boundaries, and elements at the center have a highly probability of occurrences. So probably the best example I can give this, if you look at perhaps temperature and temperature controls that you have in your labs, we have something called center-driven temperature, which means, for example, if you're controlling your lab, these are more expensive types of environmental controls. If you're closely controlling your environment, it's going to fluctuate greatly once it deviates from where you have that set. So in this example, the heating and cooling are constantly working to reach that center point where you are attempting to have that climate controlled at. So if you have it controlled at, let's say, 20 degrees C, most all values are going to be directly there on a triangular type of distribution. Making that correlation, I'm going to use the same correlation with the next type of distribution, U distribution, which is sometimes I like to refer to as boundary driven. Most all these values will fall at the end there. Population has finite boundaries, and elements near the boundaries have a higher probability of occurrence. So in contrast to center driven, you can have boundary driven type of temperature controls, where it's not controlled so tightly at the center. If you're perhaps controlled at, let's say, 20 degrees plus or minus 2 degrees, your elements are not going to cut on until they get near the limit. So in other words, it's not going to be fighting right at 20 degrees C. Going to wait on the high end till it reaches close to 20.2 or 20 or 22 degrees if it's plus or minus 2. On the other end, it would be 18 degrees. I can't recall if I said 0.2 or 1 degree C. Anyway, when you get to the limits of that range, that's where it's gonna cut off. So most of your population will be at the boundaries in these cases. General rule of thumb, somebody told me, and I think it's really true, if you're not sure, if it's not something that you statistically obtain, chances are that it's probably going to be a rectangular type distribution. If you're not sure, then you're probably best to go with the rectangular. So again, we got some terms we see that pop up here in 7.6. See, the term estimation and evaluation is utilized in the 2017 standard concerning uncertainty requirements. So where the method concludes, and this comes right out of the standard, where the test methods conclude rigorous evaluation of measurement, uncertainty and estimation may be made. A laboratory performing calibration, including of its own equipment, shall evaluate measurement uncertainty. So on the right there, more statistical calculations involved with an evaluation, with an estimation. Sort of depicted there, if it was like, for example, a big jar with a bunch of jelly beans in it, and you're trying to count that, it's not going to be an exact size. You're probably going to make a estimation as opposed to an evaluation. Okay, clause number two in the standard, a laboratory performing calibration, including of its own equipment, shall evaluate the measurement uncertainty for all calibrations. So calibration labs, you're going to be evaluating it. For you testing folks that perhaps, and we get these questions sometimes directed to me at BJLA, and we actually address this in PL2. If, for example, even your calibration folks, if for whatever reason, if you decide you were going to calibrate your own equipment, we refer to that as in-house calibration in PL2. So for those, that is looked at as same as an accredited type calibration, and all those requirements would apply. So if you have a testing lab, and let's say, for example, you're going to calibrate your own thermometers, you're going to calibrate your own balances, you have to estimate uncertainty, excuse me, wrong word, evaluate uncertainty in the same manner as a calibration lab. Of course, you have to have appropriate standards, facilities, and procedures and everything else that go along with that. So calibration labs and anyone who is performing their own in-house type calibrations, they have to evaluate the uncertainty. And again, I'm sort of depicted a sample of an uncertainty budget there, where we're identifying, quantifying, and combining and then expanding those sources of uncertainty. All right, the very last clause, 763. A laboratory performing testing shall evaluate measurement uncertainty. Where the test method precludes rigorous evaluation of measurement uncertainty, an estimation shall be made based on an understanding of the theoretical principles or practical experience of the performance of the methods. So that's a mouthful there. So what exactly are we talking about for your testing folks? You hopefully will fall in one of these buckets here. When I say buckets, we have a little, we have a couple of notes that are associated with this in the standard. Notes are additional information. They're not requirements. So the first note is, in the case where a well-recognized test method specifies limits to the values of the major sources of measurement uncertainties and specifies the form of presentation of the calculated results, the laboratory is successfully have considered to have satisfied the clause I just read in 763 by following the test methods and reporting instructions. Example would be, I'm not versed in this, but rapid method kits that specifies limits to the values of the major sources or contributors of uncertainty. As a well-recognized rapid methods where kits are used to determine qualitative results. Another note, for further for a particular method where the measurement uncertainty of the results has been established and verified, there's no need to evaluate measurement uncertainty for each result if the laboratory can demonstrate that it has identified critical influences, influencing factors are under its control. Under note three, there's an ISO guide that's referenced there for further information for testing and calibration. And sort of define what they were at the bottom. I'll leave that up there for a second for you folks to take a look at. All right. So I'm going to attempt to go ahead and go through a note one and an example. And I want to give my colleague Doug Berg credit for this part of this presentation, which I extracted from our workshop that we give on measurement uncertainty, where we incorporate both testing and calibration. And note one, I have it right up there. In the cases where real recognized test method specifies limits to the values of major sources of measurement uncertainty and specifies the form of presentation of the calculated results, the laboratory is considered to have satisfied the requirement there in 763 by following test method. And the example I'm going to run through here is ASTM D130, which is a standard test method for corrosion to copper from petroleum product by the copper strip test. Test the corrosiveness of copper to aviation fuels, gasoline, kerosene, cleaners, distillates, lubricant oil, or other hydrocarbons. So this is a test method that falls within the realm of 763. So basically, a summary is simply laid out there for you is a polish a copper strip immersed in a specific volume of the sample tested, heated under temperature and time specific to class of material, strip removal, washed in color and tarnished, assessed against an ASTM copper strip corrosion standard. So it's very detailed, very detailed specifications for the equipment, materials, test strips. There's multiple procedures that the ASTM D130 captures. It also goes over the interpretation of results and reporting the results, but doesn't directly address conventional uncertainty. So what's listed there are some of the equipment and materials that are used and the procedures associated with aviation fuels, natural gas. I'm assuming these are various procedures covered within D130. Diesel fuel oil, cleaner solvent, kerosene, and lubricating oil. So basically, we examine an interpretation according to D130, the empty the contents of container immediately, withdraw, strip, dry blot on air, dry, hold strip, and ASTM standards such that the light reflected at approximately 45 degrees will be observed. Then we interpret the results. If in comparison to the standard, the specimen is between pick the most tarnished classification. Rules for resolving uncertainty between various standards to put the strip into one of four categories that is as its description. Repeat test if fingerprint blemishes are seen or spots due to water or if sharp edges appear in another classification. Hopefully, I don't know if I have anybody listening that are involved in this specific test method, but hopefully you can correlate your testing to what I'm sort of running through here with D130. So there's an example. I'm assuming you have to have a trained eye to do this sort of test in order to read the strips. So reporting. So going through the procedure there, they're reporting the corrosive copper strip is that's their reporting is classified as a ZP with Z can be 1, 2, 3, 4 with a P classification descriptions A, B, C. So how do we meet the requirements of ISO 17025 2017 section 763? by following the method and by note one. Also, simulation study and standard. And how do we account for the standard? The method of reporting that's just specified up there. Also using the traceability through that ASTM copper strip corrosion standard. Looking at the top there, we see Z1234. That's identified at the bottom there. So it would be reading it as, I'm assuming, going from 1 through 4, slight tarnish, moderately tarnish, dark tarnish, or corrosion. All right, that's first part of the presentation. Measurement uncertainty, going over the requirements there. Like I said, measurement uncertainty, it's not one shoe fits all. Pretty much, I mentioned, I'm the calibration program manager, used to dealing with uncertainty budgets, and those big three, uncertainty, the standard, repeatability, and resolution of the device under test, are things that I would expect always to see in a budget. And then from there, you know, it just depends on the type of calibration that's being taken, that's being undertaken. Could have air buoyancy effect, where you're measuring air buoyancy, temperature, barometric pressure, humidity, that comes into play. And you'll have an uncertainty associated with each one of those. So I'm going to change gears here. Going to go to section 7.7, ensuring the validity of results. So from the 2005 standard, this correlates to the old section 5.9, assuring the quality of testing calibration results. So what I try to depict there is on the left there. So for example, testing or even calibration, if you're using balances in your testing, and perhaps you have test weights that you put on there to assure that your balance is operating within predefined limits, that would fall under this section. Sort of like an internal controls you have in place to assure that you're given your testing results are not outside of any limitations or anything that's adversely going to affect. So of course you want to check your balances, hopefully have some sort of predefined limits. If you put more than just putting that weight on and reading a value, you have you record those values and make the determination whether or not it is between the predefined limits or not. And then proficiency testing in general. So proficiency testing, PJLA, we got PL1 that are PJLA's requirements for proficiency testing. That correlates to ILAC policies. So let's look at what we have here. 7.71, the laboratory shall have a procedure. So we have a shall there. So a shall is a requirement. So we have to have something that within your lab that tells you how this is being done. Procedure is anything that tells you how something is accomplished. Okay, getting back to 7.7.1, the laboratory shall have a procedure for the monitoring validity of results. The resulting data shall be recorded in such a way that trends are detectable, and where practical, statistical techniques shall be applied to review the results. This monitoring shall be planned and reviewed and shall include, and we have where appropriate, so it's all these, of course, may not be appropriate, but to your particular line of testing or calibration, but not limited to. So what we're going over 7.7.1, or like referred to as internal controls. These are things that you do within the confines of perhaps the four walls of your organization. And there's just some, as far as a difference here in 7.7.1 and what was in the 2005 standard, pretty much still intact, but they've added a couple items to this. So we're going to go down the list here. First one is the use of reference material or quality controls materials. What we have there is pH buffers, for example, that could be used perhaps to check your pH meters. Use of alternative instrumentation that has been calibrated to provide traceable results. So if you have a known value of a item, you can run it through your test or calibration and evaluate it against the traceable value. Functional checks of measuring and test equipment. Some different modes you can put a lot of electronics through that will sort of red flag the instrument or give some sort of message if there is something quite not right with the instrument. Said these all may not be appropriate or something that you all can use. Use of check or working standards with control charts where applicable. Intermediate checks on measurement equipment, these in-between checks between the calibrations. Replica tests or calibrations using the same or different methods. Retesting or recalibration of retained items. Correlation of results for different characteristics of an items. That's one, for example, if there's a known effect that temperature has on a device or a sample, perhaps you can control that and see if your testing or calibration makes that change according to the correlation between, in my example, a temperature change. Even review of reported results. That's something that I think should always be done anyway. And actually, that's a requirement as far as reporting the results. In 7.8, you have to issue the report, and those reports are now required within the standard under Section 7.8 to be reviewed prior to being released. Intra-lab comparison. So this would be, if you have, say, three technicians performing a specific calibration or test, you have them all perform the same calibration or test, and then you compare the results in a meaningful manner. See if everybody's on the same page, if there's any outliers there. This is also, I like to, section on personnel I'm going to throw in here. You got to monitor your employees now. This is a requirement in 6.2. We're going to go through that in January, just giving you a heads up here next month. You have to monitor the performance of personnel. So an intra-lab laboratory comparison is a good way to monitor your folks' performance as well. And of course, I'm sure you would want to know if there's somebody who is producing faulty results or not up to your standards. Testing of blind samples. Could be a sample they've already tested. Have them test it again, not even knowing it's a sample that they've tested. So one thing I always recommend, if these are being done, that you make records to support that these activities are being performed. I did an assessment here recently, and they told me these wonderful things they were doing with their industrial type test weights, where they sort of sample them, make sure that they're not drifting at all. They inspect them, see if there's any damage. These are heavy duty industrial class F, class 6 types test ways. I said, that sounds great. Do you have any record that is being done? They did not. So it's wonderful that they're doing, but I would always suggest that you maintain a record if you are doing any of these things here listed under 771. Okay, second section in 7.7 is 7.7.2. The laboratory shall monitor its performance by comparison with results of other laboratories where available and appropriate. So I highlighted that there. Where available and appropriate, and you'll see why in a minute. This monitoring shall be planned and reviewed and shall include but not limited to either or both of the following. So in comparison to 7.7.1, these are external type controls where you're going to compare your data, your value, what you're producing to something outside the four walls of your organization. So what we're referring to here is by one of the following methods, participation in proficiency testing. So 17025 identifies this as, you can actually go to a proficiency testing provider. There's a note there. There's actually an accreditation standard for proficiency testing provider. 17043. You'll see we have on our website, we have resources for proficiency testing, and we do list some of these third-party providers. This would be, for an example, let's say you were calibrating gauge blocks. The third-party provider would send you a gauge blocks to calibrate just like you was a customer. So you would have values associated with degrees of uncertainty, and your comparison would be made against numerous other organizations that tested the same gauge blocks. 17043, they have criteria in place for type of reporting, type of analysis, and also maintaining control over those reference values. B is an interlaboratory comparison other than proficiency tests. So that would be what we refer to in PL1 as interlab comparison. Bare bones minimum, it's your organization and another organization test the same artifact or sample, and then compare the results in a meaningful way. So it's outside of the confines of your four walls. So that's a change for those folks that are in 2005 that are transitioning or just getting used to 2017. Standard now specifies that you have to do one or the other. And I highlighted where available and appropriate. And we addressed that in PL1. So if your organization currently complies with PL1, you're going to be complying with this requirement here under 771. Again, PL1 is PJLA's policy on proficiency testing. There's an example of interlab and proficiency testing as defined in the standard. There's one, it's two of the definitions that's been added. And there's just a quick snapshot of our website. We have a tab for resources, and one of those resources is for proficiency testing. We also have calculators up there that can help you with if you're doing an interlab test. This is our data. This is us and them. You have to analyze the data in a meaningful way. So what we have in this is where I want to address that where available and appropriate. And we address this in PL1, and even the standard says where available and appropriate. So if for whatever reason you have a valid claim to not being able to perform an interlab test or a third-party test. This is what we have in PL1. When the use of the above methods is considered by the organization as being impractical as a means of demonstrating proficiency testing, the following activities listed in their preference may be used in pending order pending prior approval by PJLA. Intralab testing and repeatability test. So intralab testing, as we defined, that is where you basically run a intralab proficiency test between your folks within your organization. And then 722, that's at the bottom of the pecking order. That's repeatability studies. That is could be very specialized test or calibration that perhaps only one person is trained to do, and there is no third party or interlab alternatives there. So the note that we added to PL1, if an organization, if you wish to proceed with one of these above mentions, the organization has to put in writing why third-party or interlab comparisons are not feasible, and how they plan to conduct the test and analyze the data. This document will be submitted to PJL headquarters for review and approval. So just a couple things that I get. One thing at PJLA, and I take a lot of pride in, is that we're consistent. We're not going to make an exception. So if you have another organization, if they're doing a third-party or an interlab test, we're not going to make an exception for somebody else under the same circumstances to do an intra or a repeatability study. So we put the onus on the lab to basically state your case, why third party or interlab is not feasible, and then how you plan to conduct the test and analyze the data. If we know there is a third party available, for example, there's no way we're going to approve an intralab test for a micrometer caliper sort of thing. There's plenty of third parties out there. A truck scale, for example, might be different. There are no third parties that can do truck scales. And that kind of would be kind of hard to conduct an intralab test. But anyway, I will leave it at that. The standard requires you to do third party and interlab where available and appropriate. If not available and appropriate, if you're accredited with us now, this is BJLA, this is our requirement for if you want to, if you have a valid case. Another thing, I'll hear proprietary reasons. And if there is a third party provider, how you got there is not of interest. What's looked at is your result and your degree of uncertainty. So typically that is not a valid reason. So still looking at the requirements under 7.7. Yes, even if you're doing an interlab test, it's not, and I just had it happen to me, here's us and here's them. Okay, well, what is it telling us? You have to analyze the data. So data for monitoring activities shall be analyzed, used to control and if applicable, improve the laboratory activities. If the results of the analysis of data from monitoring activities are found outside predetermined criteria, appropriate action shall be taken to prevent incorrect results from the proficiency, excuse me, from incorrect results from being reported. So the concept of analyzing QC data to control and improve laboratory activities is additional, added on to the 2017 standard. And I mentioned something also previously on our website. We do have a calculator. We have an e-normal analysis calculator that can assist if you are doing an interlab test that will allow you to analyze the data in a meaningful way. Basically, it will look at your value and the reference values and your uncertainty and the reference uncertainty and make a determination whether or not they are in agreement with each other. So the 2017 standard is placing more emphasis on interlab comparison and proficiency testing. Other than the fact that this 17025 standard and PL1 requires a lab to do this, there are beneficial tools for the lab to check the reliability of results by comparison within their peer groups and to demonstrate their performance to clients and accrediting bodies. With the increasing availability of proficiency testing schemes in many technical fields, the criteria for the selection of an appropriate scheme are becoming more important. So relevance of interlaboratory comparison, interlaboratory comparison, ILCs, are performed for various reasons. Of course, you have to, it's a requirement, perhaps for accreditation, but also to validate, you can be utilized to validate test procedures, to certify reference material, and to assess the competence of laboratories, or more general, to investigate the degree of comparability among laboratories. Irrespective of the special aims of an interlaboratory comparison, the results can be used by participating laboratories, not just to fulfill a requirement, however, to check the performance of its test procedures and or its staff, to demonstrate its competence toward clients and accreditation body, to gain useful information for the evaluation of its measurement uncertainty. And I listed there our website, the link directly to PJLA's resources on proficiency testing. Okay, that is the end of the presentation. So thank you all for listening. And like I said, I'm going to right now for the first time pull up the question tab. And I'll try to answer as many as I can. If I'm not sure, particularly if you have a technical question in regards to testing, I'll let you know. Is it necessary to do measurement uncertainty for every time in our scope? Or is one uncertainty incorporating all contributors sufficient? My stock answer there is it depends on the unit under test. If you are calibrating or testing the same thing, then one may be specific. I gave you an example of a thermometer. And what's on your scope is a CMC, or is it, for your calibration folks, that's the best measurement that can be produced. And when you publish on the scope of accreditation, you want to basically look at the best device you can test with your equipment, your people, your environment. So for example, if I am testing a thermometer, go resort back to temperature here, and that thermometer is graduated in 1 degree divisions as opposed to 0.1 degree division, that's going to make a significant change in the uncertainty. That would change the uncertainty value dramatically. You're not going to use the uncertainty associated with a 0.1 degree C on a device that reached 0.1. Also, repeatability. I give the example, I'm not going to name any manufacturers here. I have brand, golden brand here, just brought, paid top dollar for. I use a pipette, for example. And I've gone on to eBay and I bought an old 25-year-old pipette with old worn-out rings and seals in there. So if I do 10 measurements in a row with the Golden Goose and I do 10 measurements in a row with the one with the worn-out seals and O-rings on it, chances are I'm going to get much more better repeatability on my Golden standard. Hence the uncertainty associated with repeatability will be less in that case. Can we only have a uncertainty in our budget? Not sure what you're referring to there with an uncertainty budget, and this is in PL1 if you're accredited with us. You have to identify those contributors. So we have to see how they're identified, how they are quantified, and of course how they're analyzed. Typically they're combined and then expanded. It's just not just one. I'm not really sure if I understand the question there, but there's more to it than just can we only have type uncertainty budget. I'm not really sure I understand the question, but if that's what it is, you have to identify all the contributor. Is there an educational online measurement uncertainty software? There are. I'm not going to name any. I'm not going to. I'm not supposed to endorse anybody in particular, but that is something you can Google and you will find. I know now actually, the 2017 standard with identifying the contributors to uncertainty rather than having a procedure in place, it's much more in line with today's electronic age. So in other words, quite often today the software is looking up values and calculating uncertainty. So in other words, some things are fixed, some things you would type in perhaps the resolution, it will look at your standard deviation and calculate that for you. But yes, there are a lot of software available for uncertainty. As far as tutorials, yes, like I said, I would you can probably find various online sources to help you with uncertainty. Actually, we used to do them at PJLA. Haven't done one in a while. We used to give workshops, and like I said, it's not one shoe fits all. The problem is we had calibration people in there, testing people, and just giving a broad overview of uncertainty is kind of difficult when you have a wide array of different type of calibration and testing folks in there. I don't know what industry you're in or if there's a specific type of calibration, you may want to focus right in on that industry. I don't assess any testing labs. Somebody's asking me what kind of non-conformance. I'm a calibration person. I have sat in on it. And one thing I can tell you with a testing lab, it's not something you can ignore. You have to make the determination, hey, where does this fall into? You have to at least make a reasonable estimation of uncertainty. And that has to be shown as something that's not ignored. But you know what non-conformance is, I don't do testing. I'm a calibration individual. If I was to do a testing lab, I would have a technical person in there and I would do the quality portions. I have sat on a testing one, and I stood it to me like a sore thumb. The organization under those sections were putting NA, and I said, no, they have to, if it's NA, why? You know, it has to fall within one of those categories. All right, good questions here. Yeah, we ought to put a maybe do a testing a webinar with a panel on here. Again, this is particular to testing lab, and I apologize, I just don't know because I'm not a testing person. Is there the same level of expectations for estimation of uncertainty for micro test labs? There, you know, the thing I can say is just looking bold face at the requirement. There is no exception there. Sort of getting off our topic today. For reporting results reviewed, is secondary review required? It is. You have to review 7.8 that deals with reporting the result, and it does specify reports need to be reviewed. Also specifies that you have to have the date of issue and who issued the report. And technically, and we'll talk about personnel next week, that person needs to be authorized to do so. Am I going to address 3.7 decision rule in the near future? I've already done a couple of them on decision rules. I've done one a few months ago, and I'm putting together the. I only have January agreed scheduled for next month for excuse me next year, but if you haven't heard the other ones, like I said, you can go to our website. And I know in 2020 and perhaps 2019, bear with me. I don't know the exact dates, but I know I've done at least two of them on making statements of compliances in the decision rule. You can go on our website, go under recorded webinars, go down that list. You're bound to find them. You can listen to them, and you can also just get the slides from them. Can a laboratory analyze QCS every time they do a PT sample? You have a can there. That's not a requirement. That's a permission. So just based on that, I'll say yes. But again, it sounds like it's a testing lab. I'm not sure exactly how that correlates to every time they do a PT sample, how that correlates to uncertainty or while you're referencing proficiency testing here. There are quantitative tests. How does measurement uncertainty? Can you calculate uncertainty for quantitative tests? I think what you're referring to there, if it is something where it's just a clear, there's not a, correct me if I'm wrong, I know you can't speak to me. If it's something that you're just saying yes, no, pass, fail, typically measurement uncertainty is not associated with those types of results. You're not recording data. You're not making a data and then a statement of compliance. If you're just stating, oh, black, white, you know, yes, no sort of thing, then uncertainty is typically not into play there. Uncertainty budgets are for all instruments are needed during accreditation program. I guess what you're asking me there is, and we're just concerned with your scope of accreditation. So what's on your scope of accreditation? All the, and I'm assuming if you're a calibration lab, yes, if all the instrumentation that you're using. And I had this question emailed to me the other day, or excuse me, just this morning, out of the blue. It's not the instrument uncertainty that you're performing, it's the measurement uncertainty. So yes, the equipment is going to be part of that. And like I said, I don't want to stray too far off course here, with traceability, you're going to go to an accredited source if you're providing traceable measurements. That's part of that, the link of traceability is uncertainty. So if that equipment, if you're needing traceable measurements, then that report will have an uncertainty in it that you, of course, if you recall, I said, all right, that's your starting point. Now you're going to build another link to the chain of traceability by adding onto it your uncertainty. So all the instrumentation that are used on your scope of accreditation, they need to be incorporated into the total measurement uncertainty. I had somebody here. It was great to hear, and I hope I presented it okay. I had to have a individual talking to me about the D-130. I was looking through a presentation Doug gave, and this looked like a good one to present for the testing folks out there. And I hope I was on base with that. So I'm glad to see I had somebody that could directly relate to that. Okay, I'm reading this, and I said this is live TV. If our calibration is accredited, do we need to issue calibration reports for the unit of or under test of clients with uncertainty is must? If you're a calibration lab, you have to list the measurement uncertainty on the report. That is a requirement in 7.8 for uncertainty. You don't have to with the unit under test. So yes, that is a requirement. Review 7.8 for calibration. That is a shall. If in line with proficiency test, if an organization meets the requirement of 17034, which is for reference materials, but not necessarily in line with PL1, et cetera, it is okay. I'm not going to sit here and say, yes, it is okay. We do address reference material in PL1. There is a section on there. I didn't hit on it here, and I just don't know what the if there is any sort of exception to reference material. I do know I'm also the program manager for inspection 17020, and there are exceptions for that. But I would encourage you to, and bear in mind one thing we're doing. I hate to throw a wrench into this, but we are getting our own house in order at PJLA, and that we are updating all of our policies. One thing we need to be referencing, and we're still in line as far as when this needs to be implemented. So we're going to be updating all our policies in the near future. Our policies align with ILAC policies. And I do know that ILAC has written some things in there in regards to reference materials that we're going to incorporate in with PL1. Bear with me 1 minute, folks. I'm trying to look something up here for that last question. Some of these numbers, sometimes they get to running together. I would recommend you go to the ILAC website. You can get all their documents from directly from them. And they have guidance documents, they have G documents, they have P documents, which is policy documents. So we're sort of going through an interim with the reference material there that you're talking about in 17034. What is an ILAC is going to be crossed over to our PL1. So ILAC's policy on proficiency testing is P9, Paul 9. So if you're able to go on the ILAC website, see what's coming down the pike with proficiency testing, with reference material, review that document. Right now, I just don't know what the specific changes are. Thank you, but some clients don't ask for uncertainty. I got a thing here. Some clients don't ask for uncertainty. They only need error deviation on the reports. And I'm handling this from a calibration perspective. Calibration, as far in a report, it is required to put uncertainty. There is in 7.8, they're still available. Makes reference to simplified reporting. And this is something you should not just make the determination of yourself as an organization. It needs to be determined during contract review. Same thing with the decision rule. It's not something that you make the determination, your customer makes the determination. So if during contract review, your customer is specific, they don't want uncertainty on their reports. And they have reasons for doing it. That's fine, as long as they agree to it up front. It's their decision, not your decision. So during contract review, if they don't want uncertainty on there, but bear in mind with simplified reporting, it does not have to be reported if agreed to up front with the customer. However, it needs to be produced as requested. So even though if it's not on the report, it's something that somebody, you should maintain the records where need be, you can go back and create the uncertainty. I've never seen this. What if ASTM states the uncertainty hasn't been calculated yet? Question mark there. I would just assume if it's a contributor to your organization and it's a significant contributor to your uncertainty, that it's something that you would have to do in-house. I'm not 100. I hope I'm on track here, but I've never actually seen this in an ASTM method specifying uncertainty hasn't been calculated for PT. If it's something that is a contributor to yours, and you need to at least make some sort of reasonable estimation of it. For PT proficiency tests, do we need to go approve PT providers in our location? If not available, what to do? Okay, well, again, PL1 is our policy on proficiency tester. If you're going to do an inter-lab test, that's yourself and another organization. The other organization needs to be an accredited organization. If they are not accredited, we make some stipulations that their measurements are traceable, and it goes into detail about you would have to do. I know this doesn't mean anything boldface. Fill out an LF 123, which is basically just showing that their measurements are in fact traceable. On our website, we have a list of PT providers. If you have another source, you can present that to PJLA to review and make it determine if it's an appropriate source. So if there is a third party provider, you would be required to use that or do an interlab test. If there is no third party provider and for whatever reason, you're unable to conduct an interlab test, and bear in mind when our assessors go out and do their assessment, they're technically competent in the area. So they're gonna should know, hey, this is an area there are third party proficiency testing available. But there are instances where there is not, and there are instances where it's very difficult to, could be logistics. For example, I mentioned a truck scale, but if you're doing uniformity tests on ovens, furnaces, that sort of thing, that is a hard one. Well, there is nobody that's going to send you a furnace or oven to do a proficiency testing on. And that's not one thing you can typically ship from one location to another. That would be a candidate to put in the request for intra-lab testing. So that would be where yourself, another person within your organization would test the same artifact and compare the results in a meaningful way. So if your question is, what if there is no other alternatives? We discussed that in PL1. You just got to, for us, you have to put that in request in writing, state why third party or interlab is not feasible, and then how you plan to conduct the results, excuse me, proficiency tests, and also analyze the results. Okay. More questions. Nope, I've already read that one. I think I reached the end of the line. A lot of questions there, a lot of good questions. Some of them I wasn't real sure about, those specific ones, the testing. Like I said, it might be a good idea for us to do one of these with a panel of testing folks on there that could be specific to your, there's lots of different tests up there. So before I go, I just want to, next month, believe it or not, this is our last one in 2020, and let's hope for bigger and better things in 2021. Our first webinar is going to be on Section 6.2. Had some questions there that sort of crosswalked into 6.2 today, and that's a section on personnel. 25th January, I'm coming to you on the East Coast, my home base here in Virginia. Want to thank everybody for joining us. Wish everybody a very happy New Year, and look forward to getting together and doing this again on January 25th. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day.